Pediatric cardiac function is next, and I feel like it's finally ready. My notes are very extensive. I'm just going to go through the congenital anomalies in the heart, arrhythmias, and inflammatory diseases of the heart. I think that's it. To be more accurate, it's going to be cardiac dysfunction. So I'm going to start with the overall cardiac function is regulated with the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. The nervous system involvement means that vagal stimulation can cause bradycardia. So eating, pooping, suckling, and there's a couple other that I'm not remembering right now. Oh, extensive suctioning. So those are kind of like things that can cause vagal responses, which will drop the heart rate. Pediatrics, some things to consider are that their heart size is larger proportionally. Their cardiac output is twice that of an adult due to their higher average heart rate and higher metabolic rate. Sudden cardiac arrest is the stopping of the electrical system of the heart during usually a highly physical activity, and it's caused by cardiomyopathies, right ventricular cardiomyopathy, Marfan syndrome, congenital coronary artery anomalies, or arrhythmic disorders. Congenital long QT syndrome is one, and other arrhythmias. The prevention for cardiac arrest is just screening for cardiac issues, especially Marfan syndrome and long QT syndrome. We're going to assess for signs and symptoms that could indicate a cardiac problem, like sudden onset of heart murmurs or hypertension, especially obviously in kids, they shouldn't have hypertension. A long QT, if they're having episodes of syncope or fainting. Symptoms on exertion, if they have abnormal blood pressure, tachycardia, abnormal pulses, signs of Marfan. All of those things need to be identified and treated to help prevent the possibility of cardiac arrest at a later time. Okay, Kawasaki disease is most commonly seen in infants and children under 5 years old and is more likely to affect boys. This disease is self-limiting, which means that the inflammation will resolve after 6 to 8 weeks, but if it's left untreated, there's a 20 to 25% risk of heart complications. The classic symptoms of Kawasaki disease are conjunctivitis, a rash, that later flakes off, enlarged lymph nodes, especially the cervical lymph nodes, a strawberry tongue, cracked lips, hands and feet might be swollen and develop a rash, and then they have 5 or more days of high fever that typically doesn't respond to antipyretics. And then there's kind of like that 5-day fever is important to remember. That's a diagnostic sort of thing, that 5 days or more. Now, the treatment for Kawasaki disease is basically IVIG antibodies from other people and then aspirin. And this is one of the only times that pediatrics will receive aspirin because it has the risk of the Rye syndrome, which has encephalopathy and liver injury. So it's risk versus benefit. And then the diagnostic test is really just diagnosed by clues. So they're going to have possibly anemia, increased white blood cells, increased liver enzymes, and increased white blood cells in the urine. And then, of course, they can look at the echocardiogram and see that the heart muscle and the coronary arteries are like not happy.
Another way to remember what happens with Kawasaki disease is the mnemonic crash and burn. So crash stands for conjunctivitis, rash, adenopathy, which is enlarged lymph nodes, and strawberry tongue and hand and foot issues. And then, of course, the burn is the fever. Clinical treatment for Kawasaki disease is that main treatment is the IVIG, which is an antibody taken from other individuals. And they also give aspirin, also known as salicylic acid, and it prevents platelets from aggregating together. And we are not supposed to usually give this to children because they could develop Rye syndrome. But this is serious enough that the benefit outweighs the risk. And so it is given for Kawasaki disease. Aspirin is given to children only for endocarditis because it is a cardiac anti-inflammatory. So the things that we're studying that cause endocarditis are rheumatic fever and Kawasaki disease. So speaking of rheumatic fever is a type of inflammatory disease that is caused by a group A strep infection. It is a self-limiting illness and involves the joints, skin, brain, and heart. But carditis is the only manifestation of acute rheumatic fever that leads to permanent damage. So it causes damage to the mitral valve most often. And what it is basically a treatable condition, but if it's left untreated, it can cause this permanent damage to the heart. The clinical manifestations are carditis, a new heart murmur, tachycardia out of proportion to the fever, cardiomegaly on chest x-ray, and polyarthritis, which is seen in 35 to 66% of cases. It's a migratory, very painful joint pain that affects one joint for a couple days and then moves to another one. It affects the large joints like the knees, elbows, etc. And then the clinical treatment for it will be antibiotics to attack the type of strep that caused the infection. And then aspirin is actually indicated for treating the rheumatic fever because it's a cardiac anti-inflammatory. So even though we don't usually give aspirin to kids, this is one of those situations where the heart is inflamed, and so it is used. And then steroids are also used, and long-term prophylaxis for 4 to 6 weeks with antibiotics, and most children recover fully. The nursing considerations include the number one task is prevention. So when people come with sore throats, illnesses that seem like they might be strep, we're going to make sure that we culture them and get them tested for strep and educate them about the possibility for strep spreading. And then we're going to treat it appropriately to avoid further illness and spread. If they do have strep, we'll monitor their temperature, put them on bed rest, fluids, administer their medications, and then teach the parents that all antibiotics have to be given even once the child feels better. And that goes for the rheumatic fever medication as well as strep medication. Heart failure is going to come up many, many more times in this notes. So I'm going to go over a review. Congestive heart failure is basically the congestion refers to fluid buildup. And it can happen either the heart can't pump hard enough or it can't fill enough. There's left-sided heart failure and right-sided heart failure. Left-sided, think lungs. The fluid is backing up into the lungs, causing pulmonary symptoms. So left-sided heart failure will have dyspnea, rails and crackles, orthopnea, weakness, fatigue, nocturnal paroxysmal dyspnea, increased heart rate, a nagging cough that can be bloody and frothy, and they'll be gaining weight rapidly, 2 to 3 pounds per day. Okay, and with right-sided heart failure, fluid is backing up into the venous system. So usually the blood will come from the venous system and hit the right side, and the right side will take it right to the lungs to be resaturated. But if the right side is failing, it will back up into the venous system, and you'll see swelling of the legs, hands, weight gain, pitting edema, jugular vein distension, lethargy, fatigue, irregular heart rates, nocturia, and girth, ascites girth. And there can also be hepatosplenomegaly and anorexia. All right, next is another inflammatory heart disease. This is infective endocarditis. This is the veggies on the valve. Bacterial, fungal, or enterococci infections on the heart valves. The risk factors for this are kids with congenital heart defects, somebody with a history of rheumatic heart disease. Any central line catheter increases the risk. So people with infective endocarditis almost always have a fever, as well as a new heart murmur that results from turbulent blood flow past a damaged heart valve. And sometimes those vegetations can detach from the valve and cause embolic phenomena. The clinical manifestations of infective endocarditis include all the infection symptoms, fever, headache, chills, fatigue, and then that newer changing loud murmur, the embolic phenomena. There may also be signs and symptoms of congestive heart failure, including especially crackles in the bases of the lungs. This illness moves really quickly, and you'll see all of this within 24 hours. The treatment are antifungals, antibiotics, or both. It'll be a 2 to 8 week long therapy and treatment of the congestive heart failure if it's present as a symptom. We will assess for damage to the heart valve, and they might have to get their heart valve replaced surgically. Anyone treated for infective endocarditis will be treated with penicillin for the rest of their lives prophylactically. And that'll be about every 6 to 8 weeks. And anytime they have invasive procedures, they'll get it prophylactically too. For the nursing management, we're going to watch for congestive heart failure and embolisms. We're going to encourage them to rest, and we will be giving patient teaching about the importance of the lifelong treatment of antibiotics and the importance of finishing every dose of their antibiotics. Just to refresh, the treatment for that heart failure, if it does show up, is oxygen therapy, maintaining fluid balance, ACE inhibitors or beta blockers, and I think that's it. All right, this heart condition is called patent ductus arteriosus. While the baby is in utero, there is a vessel that goes on the pulmonary artery and connects it to the aorta. And this is the ductus arteriosus. It usually closes after the birth because the walls collapse down and it becomes a ligament, the ligamentum arteriosum. But when it stays open after birth, we call it a patent ductus arteriosus because it's passing blood through it. And this is kind of common with premature births. But within the first day after birth, the ductus arteriosus usually starts clamping shut, and within 3 weeks, it should be completely closed off and turned into that ligament. If it doesn't close off, then the baby is left with a patent ductus arteriosus. The shunt is left to right, so oxygenated blood is flowing back and taking a second unnecessary trip to the lungs. What we don't have is any deoxygenated blood escaping into systemic circulation and causing the baby to appear cyanotic. So This defect is acyanotic.
Clinical manifestations of patent ductus arteriosus include dyspnea, tachypnea, tachycardia, full bounding pulses, widened pulse pressure, hypotension. It can also be asymptomatic. They can have congestive heart failure, intercostal retractions, hepatomegaly, and poor growth. And there is a murmur that sounds like a continuous machine sound. And these babies are at high risk for respiratory infections. This is diagnosed with echocardiogram or chest x-ray. And is treated, it can be treated with an IV, ibuprofen, or indomethacin. Indomethacin is a prostaglandin inhibitor. After those treatments, then comes the surgical management. The standard is an catheter, transcatheter closure. And then there are also other surgeries, including thoracoscopic surgery with clip ligation. Atrial septal defect causes blood to be shunted from the left atrium to the right atrium because the septum in between is open. So that means that the oxygenated blood goes back through the lungs again. And this is another type of acyanotic heart defect because it's oxygenated blood going back into pulmonary circulation and not deoxygenated going anywhere. So the issue with this is it can cause a congestive heart failure. The baby can get tired easily and have poor growth. And there is a soft murmur with this one. But infants and young children with small or moderate-sized atrial septal defects usually have no symptoms and it can go away on its own. It can also be patched surgically. So surgery for atrial ventricular heart defect is done if the defect is causing significant increased pulmonary blood flow, which will cause congestive heart failure. And that surgery is usually done by a septal occluder during cardiac catheterization. Ventricular septal defect is another left to right shunt defect. The oxygenated blood will take another trip back around the pulmonary system. Since there's more oxygenated blood on the right side, they will have an increased oxygen saturation in the right ventricle and pulmonary artery. The signs and symptoms include arrhythmias and heart blocks. There may be a thrill and there will be a murmur present. A moderate or large ventricular septal defect is associated with congestive heart failure, poor growth, decreased exercise tolerance, increased pulmonary infections, and pulmonary hypertension. The baby may need a pacemaker, or they may just need oxygen for a while, and there's a good prognosis for this, and the babies can catch up on their growth. Most small defects resolve within the first 6 months of life, and so treatment is conservative, it's a wait and see, and as long as there are not signs of congestive heart failure or pulmonary hypertension. If it doesn't close spontaneously within a year, then surgery will be considered. And surgery can be done during cardiac catheterization if it's not close to the valves or very large. Diagnostic tests will be showing this on EKG, X-ray, echocardiogram. Next up is pulmonic stenosis. What's wrong here? There's a narrowing or something, stiffening, at the entrance to the pulmonary artery. And it obstructs
the pulmonary blood flow and reduces the amount of blood that is oxygenated because it decreases the blood that goes to the lungs. And it can be associated with other defects or it can be found alone. It can have no symptoms, but it might have, there's moderate to severe symptoms. They can be abdominal distension, bluish color, cyanosis, poor appetite, chest pain, fainting, fatigue, poor weight gain or failure to thrive, shortness of breath, and sudden death. They'll have low oxygen saturation because the blood flow is blocked. It can lead to congestive heart failure. There is a loud murmur, and an increase in the loudness and length of the murmur indicates worsening of their condition. Diagnostics of this include EKG, echocardiogram, chest x-ray, and then a cardiac catheterization is possible to check the internal pressure of the heart. Clinical management of this is they can do a balloon dilation of the valve performed during cardiac catheterization. And that is a percutaneous procedure done through an artery in the groin, and it will stretch the opening of the valve. And if it's unsuccessful, they would have to do a valve replacement. The prognosis is good for this. There's a 10% mortality rate. Aortic stenosis, another obstructive defect. This is the narrowing or stricture of the aortic valve, and it doesn't allow the blood to the systemic circulation as well, and it's a decrease in the amount of oxygenated blood getting to the body. The clinical manifestations, it can be asymptomatic, but with critical aortic stenosis, they will have signs of decreased cardiac output, which are faint pulses, hypotension, tachycardia, and poor feeding. Older children will have signs of exercise intolerance, chest pain, and dizziness when standing for a long period. They might have syncope, and they will have a murmur and thrill and ejection click sound. These patients are at risk for infective endocarditis, coronary insufficiency, and ventricular dysfunction. The clinical treatment is balloon dilation, and if that doesn't work, surgical valve replacement. And valve replacement will require anticoagulant therapy and eventual subsequent replacement as it wears out. Coarctation of the aorta is another obstructive defect. Many babies with this are asymptomatic and will grow normally. But with this, reduced blood flow through the descending aorta causes lower blood pressure in the lower body and higher blood pressure in the arms, neck, and head. The pressure of the pulses in the legs and feet might not be as strong as the bounding radial, neck, and brachial pulses. Older children might have weakness and pain in their legs after exercise, and infants with moderate constriction are pale, especially the lower body. They might have poor feeding, avoidant or restrictive food intake, failure to thrive, and an increased respiratory effort. They might also develop congestive heart failure. Their lower extremities might also be cool. And then with critical coarctation, their condition might deteriorate rapidly with severe acidosis and hypotension. They might need mechanical ventilation and inotropic support before surgery. And these patients are at risk for hypertension, ruptured aorta, aortic aneurysm, and stroke. And then what happens with newborns, if they have a severe coarctation, as soon as the ductus arteriosus closes, then the lower organs will suddenly get a lot less oxygen. And the kidneys are going to be one of the first organs to react to the reduced oxygen. The heart might also have heart failure due to the fluids and blood backing up. And on auscultation, there is a murmur and a thrill. And then for diagnostics, we have chest x-ray, EKG, echocardiogram, and possibly MRI. Percutaneous balloon angioplasty techniques have proved to be very effective in relieving this. So we're going to treat them with oxygen and use that balloon, which is not necessarily a permanent fix. But then they can do balloon angioplasty, and that's the primary intervention for older infants and children. And then lifelong follow-up is necessary for these people, and they will often have hypertension. Left ventricular hypoplasty, also called hypoplastic left heart syndrome, or HLHS, is a congenital heart defect that affects the left side, specifically affecting the left ventricle and ascending aorta. So also the aortic valve and mitral valves might be too small to allow enough blood through, or they might be absent altogether, called atresia. It's unknown what causes this, but it's also associated with other congenital heart defects, in particular atrial septal defect. And then the clinical manifestations of HLHS are: within hours after birth, the newborn will have progressive cyanosis and signs of congestive heart failure as the ductus arteriosus begins to close. Tachycardia, tachypnea, dyspnea, retractions, decreased peripheral pulses, poor peripheral perfusion, pulmonary edema, and congestive heart failure lead to shock, acidosis, and death without intervention. There is no heart murmur for left ventricular hypoplasty, but there is a loud S2 sound. So it's a distinct lub-dub. And it should be something that we hear on auscultation. The clinical treatments: prostaglandin E is immediately given to help keep the ductus arteriosus open, because that's the only way that blood can make it through. The baby will need to be intubated and ventilated, and the metabolic acidosis needs to be treated. These babies pretty much just need a new heart. So their treatment options include surgery or a heart transplant, and they're immediately referred to palliative care and the transplant team, because death is basically the alternative. And sudden death can also occur several years after surgery, and they will have complications long-term if they do survive. Our nursing considerations are: we're going to do a thorough assessment prior to surgery, including physiologic assessment, psychosocial assessment with family-centered planning. They're going to have long-term home care if the baby gets to come home. And we will be assessing for complications, assessing for worsening condition, meeting the oxygenation requirements and the metabolic and nutritional needs, making sure the fluid volume balance is taken care of, skin integrity, management of illness and medications, prevention of complications, and then dealing with the family because they're adjusting and dealing with a lot with this one. All right, tetralogy of Fallot. Tetralogy of Fallot is a congenital heart condition where patients have four different heart abnormalities. This is actually the most common cause of cyanotic congenital heart defects, accounting for about 50 to 70% of those, as well as about 10% of all congenital heart defects in general. The amazing snowboarder Shaun White had this. A mnemonic to use to remember the four different defects is PROOVE. P is for pulmonary stenosis. R is for right ventricular hypertrophy. O is for overriding aorta. V is for ventricular septal defect, and E is for excellent. We know them all. So the pulmonary stenosis, we've already talked about, it refers to the pulmonary artery being limited to get blood to the lungs. The right ventricular hypertrophy is going to keep the right ventricle from contracting effectively. And so that also limits the blood going to the lungs. The ventricular septal defect, we already talked about, and that's letting some of the blood mix. And in this case, deoxygenated blood is mixing with oxygenated and going to the body. And then the aorta, the overriding aorta, is that the position of the aorta is above the septal defect. So it is receiving, instead of just pure oxygenated blood, it's receiving that mix of blood that's deoxygenated and oxygenated. So you can imagine the clinical manifestations of this are a blue baby. The baby is hypoxic and cyanotic as the ductus arteriosus closes. Usually this is diagnosed early. The degree of pulmonary stenosis is what's going to determine the severity of the symptoms. Tachypnea and cyanosis will show up in older infants and children. There is a murmur. They'll have poor growth, clubbing of their fingers, exercise intolerance, polycythemia, which is excess red blood cells. They can have a palpable thrill. And then if they have this in toddlerhood, they will have the squat instinct to slow venous return and keep some of their oxygenation. The babies will often have cyanosis around their lips and fingernail beds at birth, and they can have clubbing of their fingers and toes within a few months. On the other hand, if it doesn't have a severe right ventricular obstruction, they might not be cyanotic. But anyway, they can be affected with a lot of symptoms, including feeding difficulty and failure to gain weight and develop normally. The clinical treatment for this are waiting and seeing, see how they do, see how monitoring them for metabolic acidosis or prolonged unconsciousness. Most infants will have corrective surgery by 1 to 2 years unless they have a hypercyanotic TET spell before that. They will be on long-term oxygen until surgery, and some children need a temporary palliative surgery to delay the total corrective surgery until they're stronger. So if prosthetic material is used for the corrective surgery, then they will be on infective endocarditis prophylaxis for 6 months. The prognosis for this is good. Valve replacement is going to have to be repeated every 10 to 20 years, and they might have ventricular dysrhythmias later on in life. One important note about this is because this is a right to left shunt, it can allow air that's in the venous system to go directly to the brain. It results in an air embolism. Therefore, all IV lines should have filters to prevent air, and all the tubings and connections will be checked and secured and all air removed. Okay, cardiac dysrhythmias. These are, in children, these are going to be either too fast or too slow. Brady dysrhythmia is an abnormally slow rate. So if their heart rate drops below 60, this is bradycardia, and it is bad in kids and infants. And this is most commonly caused by hypoxemia. Without enough oxygen, the heart rate slows down eventually, and it's can be caused by hypoxia, hypotension, hypervagal tone, heart block, hypothermia. It can be drug-related or from congenital heart disease. And the one clinical treatment is a pacemaker. Causes of pediatric dysrhythmias include respiratory and distress and shock. Those are the most common causes. They can also be from unrecognized respiratory or metabolic compromise, congenital cardiovascular anomalies, long QT syndrome or Marfan syndrome, Tachydysrhythmias are an abnormally rapid rate. So sinus tachycardia is one tachydysrhythmia. The clinical manifestations are poor perfusion, delayed capillary refill, pale, cool extremities, mottled skin, decreased blood pressure, dry mucous membranes, decreased number of wet diapers, increased stool, diarrhea, or vomiting, and increased work of breathing. Can be caused by fever, pain, blood volume loss, caffeinated drinks, congenital heart disease, excessive crying, anemia. So the clinical treatment for sinus tachycardia is supporting the ABCs. We're going to use oxygen, look for the cause, whatever's causing this, and treat it. If it's due to hypokalemia, we will obtain vascular access and do a fluid bolus, unless it's a cardiac cause. If it's due to fever, we will monitor and maintain normal body temperature. If due to pain, we will treat with analgesics. And then further, there's supraventricular tachycardia, which is one of the most common tachydysrhythmias in infancy. It's defined by a heart rate over 220 beats per minute in infants or over 180 beats per minute in children. It has no beat-to-beat variability and a rapid onset. The clinical signs of SVT are pallor, cyanotic or mottled due to decreased cardiac output, poor feeding, hypotension, altered level of consciousness, irritability, signs of congestive heart failure, may have chest pain, diaphoresis, palpitations, dizziness, decreased urine output due to poor organ perfusion, and the heart rate can be too fast to manually count. This can cause congestive heart failure and organ damage. The kidneys and the lungs can begin failing as well as the heart. For clinical treatment of supraventricular tachycardia, it is beta blockers or digoxin for chronic SVT. For an initial treatment, vagal maneuvers, ice application to the face, massage of the carotid artery, Valsalva maneuver, rectal thermometer, telling them to poop or bear down if they're able. And then if those fail, they will have an adenosine rapid IV push with a saline bolus immediately after. If that fails, then it's defibrillation. They can do radio or cardioversion or radio frequency ablation. And then as the blood pressure goes up, the cardiac output goes down. As the heart rate goes up, the cardiac output goes down. And the next one is atrial fibrillation. And this is an irregular heartbeat from 100 to 175 beats per minute with twitching of the atrium. This delivers less blood effectively or delivers blood less effectively. And the symptoms are general fatigue, dizziness, shortness of breath, weakness, palpitations, and one complication is stroke. And ventricular tachycardia. Only the ventricles are working. It is a heart rate above 120 with regular rapid rate with a wide QRS complex. There are no P waves. This is not effective pumping and very little cardiac output is coming. The rate can be from 100 to 250. The rhythm is regular. P wave, not visible. PR interval, there is none. The QRS complex looks wide, like tombstones. And there are irregular coarse waveforms of different shapes. The ventricles are quivering and there is no contractions or cardiac output and it may be fatal. Untreated ventricular tachycardia leads to ventricular fibrillation and death. And VFib is the next thing. VFib has zero cardiac output. It's call a code. This is uncommon in pediatrics, but if it happens, we are really worried, and it leads to cardiac arrest. Ventricular fibrillation looks like a rapid, disorganized pattern of electrical activity in the ventricle. And the rate is unknown. The rhythm is chaotic and irregular. There's no P wave, there's no PR interval, and there's not a visible QRS complex. Treatment for this is CPR, oxygen, and defibrillation. Defib, the V-fib. Drug therapy is vasoconstrictors, antiarrhythmic, and possibly magnesium. Asystole, also known as flatlining. This is, there's no rate, no rhythm, no P wave, no PR interval, no QRS complex. The treatment for this is high quality CPR. The heel of the hand on the center of the chest, arms straight, shoulders aligned over your hands, compressed at 2 inches at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute. 30 compressions to 2 rescue breaths with minimal interruptions. This is caused by myocardial infarction or ischemia, heart failure, electrolyte imbalances, severe acidosis, and plenty of other things. And that's it. The heart stuff is finally done. Only 39 minutes. Okay, bye.